This is Radio Influence.
He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he scores the top.
Wow.
And here comes a mention. And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich
one
Franklin
punch
retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
UFC Fight Night 108 and Bellator 178 took place this past weekend, and we are going to recap what happened on those fight cards here on this episode of the MMA Report post-fight podcast on Radio Influence. Daniel Galvan and I will talk about some of the major storylines that happened over the weekend. Of course, Cub Swanson gets a unanimous decision win over Artem Lobov. He has said that he wants a title matchup as his next matchup. And of course, Patricio Pitbull became a two-time Bellator featherweight champion with a submission victory over Daniel Strauss. We'll also get an Ally Quinta. Ovince St. Preux, is he a free agent? We'll get into that, plus so many other things here to recap on this episode of the Post Fight Podcast. But of course, we are brought to you by Fight TV. Fight is a go-to app for MMA fans and practitioners, live pay-per-views, TV tapings, full-length matches, interviews, movies, and documentaries. Get a front-row seat to live wrestling, MMA, and boxing action anytime, anyplace. Get Fight free and see what's streaming now for you. You can download the Fight app today free by going to Fight, FITE.TV/RadioInfluence/. Once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV/RadioInfluence/. And that link is also available on RadioInfluence.com. Of course, every weekend, Fight TV has a ton of MMA action. And of course, you can check out their schedule of events they have at their website, fight.tv. Daniel, how's your weekend, man?
It went good, man. Just got back last night from the D-League Finals on ESPNU in the Rio Grande Valley. So that was really cool working behind the scenes on that broadcast. But, you know, caught the fights, caught Bellator, caught UFC Fight Night. Wasn't able to catch Battleground. Which you were working there. How'd that go for you, man?
It went good. You know, it's always an interesting experience. You know, one of the things I always say in broadcasting is you take advantage of every opportunity that comes your way, whether it's television, radio, it's on the mic, behind the mic. It was a good experience. You know, a couple of knockouts. It was interesting. The end of the fight is, you know, when I called the end of the fight, I initially thought I screwed it up. You know, because, you know, it was a weird ending where it's a knockout where it's a liver kick, and the referee never waves his hands off. So initially I call it, hey, it's over. But then on the broadcast, I'm like, well, is it over? Because this referee never put his hands to wave it off. And so on Saturday morning, I go back and watch it. And yeah, the referee actually never waved the fight off. It was weird that there was times where I just thought the referees just, I think they just expected the fighters to just stop fighting when the bell rang, and that didn't exactly happen. So, but overall, it was a good night, good learning experience for me, and look forward to whenever my next play-by-play in MMA will be.
Yeah, man, and I will say, I mean, you working play-by-play, me kind of behind the scenes on the ESPN basketball broadcast, is I do think it reminds you, and I know you work with the Bucks with the play-by-play, but it does remind you that when we do listen to commentators and we can pick apart kind of what they do sometimes when there's like one flub, it makes you appreciate their job because it is kind of ridiculously hard because they have people in their ear every second of the mm-hmm. way. They have to listen while, you know, give the viewer zero belief that no one else is communicating with them. It is literally like you're on fire dancing and juggling three bowling pins, and you have to come across perfect on the broadcast. It's really impressive when you really, if you don't go out there and embarrass yourself, I find that pretty impressive. It does seem overwhelming, I think. And, you know, whenever we do criticize announcers or whatever, always keep that in mind that it is absolutely hard and at times terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that makes this what I did with a little difficult is that there's no commercial breaks. So, I mean, literally, I think we started about 8:15, and I didn't take the, you know, outside of going into the cage to interview the winner, I pretty much didn't take the headsets off till so close to midnight. So it really makes you, you know, and I think the one thing people probably don't understand is the amount of prep work that goes into it. I mean, last week, I mean, pretty much every day I was, you know, sitting down with fighters and getting as much information as I could, you know, for the broadcast, because you're always trying. But it was a good learning experience for me. Actually, we happened to be in a short intermission, and we saw the head kick knockout by AJ McKee, which was, man, what a knockout he had. I mean, but even, I mean, Mike Perry one-ups him. But when you think about the biggest storylines of this weekend, I can understand why, you know, maybe someone mentions from the Bellator card the McKee knockout or Pitbull winning the title, or when you look at the UFC card, Ovince St. Preux with that Von Flue choke, maybe it's Hector Sandoval with that knockout, or Bram Moreno with his technical submission. But to me, the biggest takeaway from this weekend has to be Ally Quinta, right?
Yeah, I would say it's 1A and 1B. We'll talk about 1B in a second, B, and I would say the Bellator main event, given the controversy afterwards regarding the cage fine. But in terms of, and you had a title switch, but in terms of what we saw transpire, Ally Quinta's win over Diego Sanchez was certainly one of the main stories of the weekend. It was dominant. It was quick. It was a return to form for a guy who had been away for a while, dealing with contract negotiations. And I would assume that will continue after this fight. But simply put, Jason, Diego Sanchez was having a career renaissance, and Ally Quinta put a big time stop on that in that fight.
And you look at Diego Sanchez, I mean, this is a guy that has been in the UFC for a long time. And one of the things I think that people always thought about Diego was that chin. And now you look at what has happened in his past couple of fights here, where he has ultimately been stopped in two of his last three fights by Joe Lozano. And now Ally Quinta, both of those in first rounds and almost at the identical same time here, kind of makes you wonder, you know, what's the future hold like for Diego Sanchez. But you know, a beautiful knockout win there. We both didn't think they would do the post fight interview with Ally Quinta, but I liked how Brian Stan's like, hey Al, remember we're on FS1 here.
Yeah, I mean, at some point in time, what takes place in the cage necessitates an interview, no matter who it is. And I just want to see this dude fight again and consistently, because this was just a dominant performance. And in this lightweight division, I don't necessarily know what the ceiling is for Al. He looked great here. This wasn't a long time in the cage, so we weren't able to completely gauge where he's at. But I think it's safe to say this guy clearly possesses big-time upside. You want to see him get matched up against the top 12, top 10 type guys, because Ally Quinta, you know, coming out of the Ultimate Fighter, I think he started out like 3-2 in his UFC run there. And then he's pieced together five consecutive wins from 2014 to now. And I just want to have an answer to the question of how good is Ally Quinta. Clearly, he came in against Diego Sanchez and just stomped him. You know, Sanchez has a good chin. He may still have it. It may just be the fact that Ally Quinta has bricks for hands. But I'm assuming if you're 35 years old, you go through all the wars Diego has gone through. It goes away throughout time. So for Ally Quinta, again, simply put, this was a highlight reel fight. You could just run through the entire fight on a replay. And this guy kind of checks all the boxes, Jason. Obviously checks the skill level, checks the unique in terms of this isn't a guy we've seen challenge for a title before. He's got charisma, and he's got a great camp behind him in terms of helping promote him. So I really hope we see him fight again soon, and I hope he gets paid. I hope he gets that paycheck.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting to see, and really, I think when it comes to Ally Quinta, where the more the narrative with him right now is about what happened after the fight as opposed to what happened in the fight, of course. You know, when the bonuses come out, Ally Quinta responds to the UFC's tweet about that, saying, you know, F the UFC and all that. It was interesting, and Robert Sargent of MMA Rising brought this up on Sunday, that if you looked at the UFC social media schedule on Sunday, they were showing a lot of love for Ally Quinta, but, you know, and had multiple people ask me about what's Ally Quinta's contract situation. I'm not sure how many fights are left on his deal, but you think about how he is handling himself. I think this is like a kind of a good situation in a way for the UFC, because they're ultimately going to find out, is Alec Iaquinta a fighter that fans care about?
That's an interesting question to have, because, I mean, I don't know who you're talking about when you're talking about fans, because if you're talking about the hardcore subset of mixed martial arts fans, I would say absolutely 100%. But obviously, Alec Iaquinta's name still isn't one that resonates with casual fans. I doubt you'll go to a casual fan, mention Alec Iaquinta, and they'll be able to tell you anything about him. But that's the case for most mixed martial arts fighters at this point in time. So he's, again, what Alec is a guy that they need to have talented, deep, rich divisions. And if you let guys like that go, if it's kind of like a Jenga tower, Jason, where you just keep on pulling out the blocks, then eventually it looks like Volkan Ozdemir is your sixth best light heavyweight. And I don't know if I said that already, but that's kind of the theme here for the UFC in the year 2017, is if you let these guys go, and I know we have some guys, I think you mentioned OSP is a free agent. You let these skilled top 15 type guys go, eventually you're not going to realize how poor your divisions are. So Alec Iaquinta, despite the fact that he is in a pretty deep division at 155, when you look at a guy who can simply go out there and put out a knockout of the night type performance, despite the fact he wasn't awarded it, which I disagree with. The Brandon Moreno one was great, but clearly I thought this was a much bigger deal and more exciting. So Iaquinta is a guy I think the UFC needs to, fondle, make feel good, promote, etc. What say you, Jason? You think Iaquinta is a guy that the UFC can kind of, the headaches are too much. It seems like any little thing he'll take as a slight. What would you do if you're the UFC with Al?
I think you just have to have a sit-down conversation. I mean, this is the thing is, even if Al was a free agent tomorrow, if you're Bellator, are you sitting there going, what if we bring him in, make him happy financially? Is two fights later he going to be mad and we're going to get this version of Al? I think that's something to throw out there. I mean, he said that, you know, he made $26,000 to show for this one. You imagine that it was $26,000 to win. And we got this comment from Rodney mentioning about Al in his post-fight media scrum and his comments to the UFC on Twitter after saying this. He made himself must-watch television. I can understand that he's not enthusiastic about his $26,000 a show, $26,000 to win payout, especially when he loses out on his sponsorship deals he may have in place per fight. One thing for sure is Alec Iaquinta is a must-watch interview in the cage and out of the cage. I mean, I think this is where the UFC is going to be looking at, okay, is this a guy that the fans are going to be interested in? In terms of what is going to make Alec Iaquinta financially happy to fight, I wonder what that number is. Is that number double what he's currently making? Is it more than that? I mean, look, I understand the frustration of fighters when it comes to the sponsorship angle of it. I get all of that. But I also believe that there are some fighters that believe you can go to the UFC and Bellator and you're going to get the same type of sponsorship deals. And all you have to do is go listen to a Benson Henderson interview when he talks about this. And Benson has made this clear. He will not devalue himself just to take sponsors in Bellator. He has a rate. If you're going to meet that rate, great. If not, he's not going to take the sponsorship. However, there are Benson Henderson's in the minority in terms of how fighters view sponsors. There's a lot of fighters that will take whatever they can get. And ultimately, that's not great long-term for fighters, because ultimately it continues to lower their value.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one to grapple with, because it's obviously important to understand that at this point in time, even now with this sport, this isn't a great sport. This is a great sport for the top 2% of fighters in terms of finances. But when you look at the other 98%, it is a struggle from the sponsors, especially if you're handicapped or you can't get your own sponsors for in-cage stuff, if you're a UFC fighter, to the bottom line paycheck. I mean, it is a big-time risk. He got the paycheck here. It's his first fight night paycheck since April 4, 2015. And it's 26,000, what you said there. This is a tough one. You got to fight for every single scrap of dinero that you can, because you are the only one that cares about your own self-interest. So you must be selfish. And I would advise all fighters to pick up a little bit of what Al Iaquinta is throwing down. Maybe not as dramatic. Again, I think Iaquinta at this point in time has kind of put himself in a position where the perception around him is like, if Dana White accidentally looks at him the wrong way, he has a mental lapse. Al Iaquinta may think that Dana White gave him the meanest look anyone could give him. So it seems like at this point in time, he is, every single little thing is just a net negative. He's being treated poorly, et cetera, et cetera. Grass is greener on the other side, going somewhere else he may like for a couple fights, and then, like you said, get disappointed again. But at the end of the day, if you're a fighter who isn't Conor McGregor, which is every other fighter, you got to have that attitude so you can keep the lights on, have a nice house, and provide for your family. This isn't the NFL. It isn't baseball. It isn't the other sports. We're still at a point in time where we are working this stuff out, and maybe it's going to take what Benson is doing, a more concerted effort to get those sponsorship payments, you know, at a decent rate for most fighters. But that's a tough problem to have, and I certainly don't have the answer. I mean, that's going to take a unified effort.
And, you know, the thing about sponsorships, and you know, and people like to, you know, make different examples, but here's one I always like to bring up. You know, is what's it say about MMA fighters that there are companies that are not willing to sponsor them unless their logo is on their shorts on fight night? To me, that says a lot about where we're at currently as a sport. You know, to bring in an NFL example of this, Tom Brady is sponsored by Under Armour. But when you see Tom Brady, you know, doing a press conference for, you know, the Patriots, and the Patriots logo is behind him, is he wearing Under Armour? No, he's not allowed to. If he does, he ultimately gets fined for that. So, but obviously, and I know you can't compare Al Iaquinta to Tom Brady. I'm just kind of using that as an example of, you know, Tom is able to get sponsorships, or even other smaller football players are able to get sponsorship outside of what they do on the football field. I mean, to me, that says something about where we're at as a sport overall, that there are very limited amount of companies that want to sponsor a guy when they know their logo can't be, you know, on their shorts on fight night. I think that says a lot about where MMA still is at. The fact that there are not many companies out there that are willing to, you know, sponsor a guy when they know he can't wear those logos on fight night.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, you alluded to the answer to your question, which is just like, obviously, it comes down to, when you're looking at it from the sponsorship standpoint, and this is all assumption here, but you want to get value out of whatever you're doing there. And for Tom Brady, you get immense value out of him doing commercials or him promoting you outside because he's such a famous athlete. Whereas for most mixed martial arts fighters, if you're a mainstream sponsor, the biggest value you're going to get is them on TV wearing your thing. Unless you get real, real creative with it, with your marketing, with your sponsorship, you kind of look at what a guy like Gary Vaynerchuk, who's like an entrepreneur, he runs a sports agency. He does some interesting stuff with his athletes where it's a bit unique with things outside the box in terms of promoting, getting the sponsors, getting the paychecks. That's probably what you're going to have to do at this point in time for most mixed martial arts fighters because they just don't have that same spotlight. So you also have to understand that it comes down for these sponsors, where's the real value we're getting out of sponsoring these fighters? And mostly it's, you know, in front of 700,000 viewers on Spike TV, or, you know, 1.4 mil on what did DJ get on Fox? What was the viewership for that?
What was that
far off the top of your head?
1.7?
1.7. So, I mean, that's a rough one for national TV. And you also have to keep into account, this is a big time assumption by me, by the way. I don't know. But would not be surprised if so the WWE, I believe their commercials, they have great viewership for like their Monday Night Raw, but their commercials, I believe, are much less than other sports because I think a big time part of their market share are people of lower income, like me, and like Hispanics too, like me. That's a big time part of their market makeup. So if you look at a sport like golf, or I would assume tennis, you have a much more higher income viewership. So there's more motivation for these companies to give big time money to these athletes because it's more likely that higher income is going to then purchase their product. So I would assume it's like that for most combat sports, especially on TV. So maybe that's another role for that, I would assume. But again, I mean, it's a big time mess that you gotta figure it out. But I think Al's on the right track.
Yeah, you know, you look at, and what was interesting to me was I went to a sporting event here in Tampa on Saturday. I went to an arena football game. I had not been to an arena game in probably a decade. Of course, they only have four teams now in the league. But after the fights are over, we go to a sports bar that's right across the street from the arena. And this was, you know, probably right as the main card had started. And we walked in. How many TVs do you think had the fights on?
I would assume one.
Zero. And that was kind of like, I was sitting there, we were walking around, and I was like, man, wow, that says something. Cause so we pulled the fights up on our phone, and that's how we watched the Mike Perry knockout over Jake Ellenberg. We ended up going to another bar and they had it on, and, you know, and even, we got there during, I want to say it was OSP fights when we got to the second bar we went to. And we were, I would say, one of the few people actually watching the fight. So that you know, and I think that does say a lot, you know. And I always say, as a reporter, you know, podcast host, when you go out and you are around other sports fans, it's always very interesting. And I just remember, I think it may have been the Ally Quintify, I just kind of looked around and didn't really see much people paying attention to the fights. And I mean, I know you can't make a general statement by going to one sports bar, but it was, to me, it was just interesting to see that. But you know, maybe this ultimately can make Ally Quinta into a bigger star. I mean, the question, you know, to me is how much money is it going to take to make Ally Quinta happy?
And I just want to go back real quick. When I was talking about the WWE one, I want to shout out Dave Meltzer. That's where I got most of that information from. That was my paraphrasing what he was kind of writing in his newsletter. But how much money, Jason? I don't know.
50,000 guaranteed to fight?
I mean, that makes sense in my head because 50,000 is a nice whole number. It's half of 100,000. And you have to, I guess, go and look at what the comparisons are. And maybe go in terms of guys that are in that 5 through 10 range. And then maybe if you're Al's management, go like 20% higher than that or whatnot. But 50,000, if I'm the UFC, I'm not super sure what their financial structure is like. But it's worth it because if Bellator were to get him, that's another guy to add to the 1927 Yankees. So imagine an Ian Quinta Michael Chandler fight.
But here's the thing. We saw Bellator have to deal with a fighter that was outspoken in Will Brooks. Would they want to deal with Ally Quinta if all of a sudden two fights in he's not happy?
Yes, I think so. Because I understand it. I understand what you're saying there, Jason. I would say two things. Usually when you get an outspoken fighter to leave the UFC or leave Bellator for another promotion, they tend not to be outspoken wherever they go unless their deal is real rough. So
yeah,
it's worth the risk because at the end of the day, if you sign Ally Quinta, that is just a phenomenal signing. Like I said, Michael Chandler versus Ally Quinta. Let's say Chandler beats Brett Primus, who he may not win, but on that pay-per-view, that's a beautiful fight. So you're in the position, Jason, where you're Bellator, you really should not worry about situations like that unless it is incredibly dramatic. And if it does get that way, cut bait with the guy.
And look, Bellator needs to add some depth at 155. I mean, no disrespect to Brent Primus, but you know what's it say about that division when he was really their only option?
Yeah, and there is a bit of a fatigue up on the top of that division, but they do need to add that. As to that, I mean, even you look at featherweight, which they have some nice things in the works, obviously. You know, you have the future in the division with AJ McKee, James Gallagher. But, I mean, we've seen the Strauss-Pitbull fight now four times in a row. So some of these lighter weight classes certainly do need infusions. But I would say lightweight isn't one you think of for any promotion that there is a lack of depth for a top-tier talent. But you could certainly make that case for Bellator I mean, honestly, for Bellator, it's all about adding talent to every single division. There isn't really one division where you feel super duper amazing about it if you're that promotion.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioned about the featherweight division. You know, both of these events were headlined by featherweight bouts. You look at Cub Swanson, you know, very clear win over Artem Lobov. I think that, you know, look, everyone was down on this fight heading into it, but I think Artem, you know, in defeat, got a lot of respect from people in this matchup. But Cub Swanson has now won 4 in a row. He's 10-2 in his last 12 fights. Now, of course, both of those losses are to guys who currently are ranked above him, that being Frankie Yeager and the interim champion Max Holloway. After the fight was over, you know, noted that, you know, he's looking to come back at the end of the year. You know, he's having a baby in August. So he said, you know, look, towards the end of the year, November, December is when he would like to return. He would like to get the winner of Jose Aldo and Max Holloway. Of course, you're going to have the interim title fight coming up on June the 3rd. And, you know, initially when I heard him say that, I was like, really? Should Cub Swanson be next? But then when you look at the rankings, there's a good argument to give Cub Swanson the next title shot.
Well, I would say he's in prime booty call position, Jason. You know what I'm saying? He's not the guy the UFC should go for next, but if things don't work out, if you got an injury, you pick up the phone, you dial Cub's number, and you ask him to bring you the bear to bring the honey, okay? He ain't next, Jason. He's right there. He's right there, but...
Who has a better case, though?
Oh, next week, Jason. If Yair Rodriguez beats Frankie Edgar, he should get the next title shot against the Holloway Aldo winner. Do you disagree with that? Like, would you put Swanson over Rodriguez if Rodriguez beats Edgar?
Man. Yair Rodriguez probably would be the best, but what happens if Frankie Edgar wins that fight? Are you potentially wanting to see another Frankie Edgar Jose Aldo matchup?
Well, who says Aldo's going to... I mean, with that one, Holloway has to win. If Holloway wins, you do Edgar Holloway. Mm-hmm. If Aldo wins... Well, I mean, there is history between Aldo and Cub Swanson. Aldo, I don't know if it was Aldo's first fight in the WEC, but it's the first one I remember where he jumps up and knocks Cub Swanson out with a flying knee. But that was a ways away ago. It'd be a beautiful story to tell. But if Aldo wins, if Edgar wins, that's when you get the booty call. You put Swanson there. So I think Swanson needs a big fight. He did a deal here where he took on a fighter who did not offer him much in terms of elevating his stock. Artem Lobov, in fact, elevated his stock in the loss. Like you said, if the UFC ranked every single fighter in the division, I feel like today Lobov would actually be ranked higher than he was prior to this fight. But Swanson completely outstruck him. So, Jason, I would say this to you. Yair Rodriguez deserves a title shot if he wins this fight. If Jose Aldo loses to Holloway, and if Edgar wins, you do Edgar Holloway. And then if Aldo wins, then you could talk me into Swanson Aldo. In terms of what you do with Swanson, potentially a rematch with Ricardo Lamas, but you know what West by Willie is Swanson versus Korean Zombie. Do that fight. I feel like that fight puts the winner in a position for a title shot.
Here's, I think, what hurts Cub Swanson. Even though right now he is currently ranked as a number 4 title challenger, and by the way, he's also lost to Ricardo Lamas, who's at the number 3 spot right now. If you go in his last 10 wins, where he's gone this 10-2 stretch, tell me the best win. The wins are George Roop, Ross Pearson, Charles Oliveira, Dustin Poirier, Dennis Seaver, Jeremy Stephens, Hakran Diaz, Tatsuya Kawajiri, Duho Choi, and Artem Lobov.
Yeah, I would tell you that it's probably either Duho Choi or Dustin Poirier, but Poirier was like way back then, like 2013. So I would probably say Choi. Granted, he didn't get a finish in any of those last 4 fights over Diaz, Kawajiri, Choi, and Lobov. And he's put together a winning streak. He's been around for so long that he's established himself as a top 6 featherweight for sure. He's clearly kind of at the apex of his career at this point in time. At some point in time, it's going to go downwards. This guy's got back-to-back fight of the nights. So, like I said, that's why he's in a position where if you're top 6, you should be calling for a title shot, I would say. Mm-hmm. But from the outside looking in, it's just not there quite yet. The stake isn't ready. But again, he certainly is in a position where if things go haywire, Cub's a guy you can call, put in the title picture, and give him the championship fight. With that being said, at this point in time, we talk about fighters that no one knows. Like, a Swanson title fight wouldn't necessarily do big business, but you could make the case from a sporting perspective. And the Lamas fight, you could go and do that, given that Lamas only has 1 win. I mean, you know, bro, and that fight happened in 2013 as well, I want to say, or maybe way back, actually 2011.
Yeah, I think the thing, if probably the UFC, maybe you've already told Cub, hey, if something happens on June 3rd, would you be able to step in?
Yeah,
exactly. I think, and maybe that is his best opportunity right now. I mean, yeah, if Yair Rodriguez beats Frankie Edgar, you know, and I think probably the big question of that fight is can he keep the fight on the feet and not, you know, get put on his back? But yeah, Yair Rodriguez would definitely. But you know, look, this fight definitely raised the stock of Artem Lobov. So he, you know, there. Obviously, we talked about Ovince St. Preux just minorly. Submission win over Marcus Ruggiero de Lima. De Lima misses weight by 4 pounds on Friday, that ends up getting fined 30% of his purse. OSP did take the fight as a catchweight, and OSP after the fight, he would not firmly confirm that he's a free agent, but makes it sound like if he's not a free agent, he has one fight left on his deal. And this is a guy that between him and Scott Holtzman are really the big key of why essentially MMA is still taking place in the state of Tennessee. That was talked on the last week's Valor Hour with Tim Loy and Casey Oxendine, basically the fact of the UFC committing to going to the state of Tennessee once a year, which is keeping that commission going there. But a big win by Ovince St. Preux, and you know, we talk about this light heavyweight division, and we constantly talk about the fact of Volkan Oezdemir is currently the number 5 title challenger. Of course, you know, he won a UFC debut earlier this year against OSP. It's a win for OSP, but I think the one thing you always kind of say about OSP, and when you think about his standing in this division, is, you know, he's clearly a top 10 guy. There's no doubt about it. But I think with him, you're always looking as, can he take that next step in his career? I mean, look, it was a big win he had against Shogun back in 2014. But outside of that, it's like, where is that next top 5 win? And we just haven't seen that yet with Ovince St. Preux. I mean, I think if you're UFC, you got to try to bring Ovince back. But, you know, look, it comes down to is it financially what you want to pay him?
Look, Ovince St. Preux ain't as sexy as Ryan Bader. And Ryan Bader wasn't too sexy either. But you got to sign him back. Because if you sign away Ovince St. Preux, who in God's name is going to be the 15th ranked heavyweight in the UFC? You need to sign any human being that is considered a top 30 person who weighs 205 pounds if you're the UFC. You need to sign every human being in that range of your Bellator as well. This division is barren mm-hmm. past the top two, past the top three. So I get it. Ovince St. Preux certainly has a whole heck of a lot of work to do to put himself in a position for a championship fight. He's going to have to win at least one more fight. But that says more about 205. This guy lost 3 in a row, 2 of them to just guys with big-time respect in Manoa Jon Jones, 1 in Volkan Oezdemir, who we don't know quite yet what's going to happen with this dude's career. So he has a little bit of work to do, but at the end of the day, he's still a top 10 light heavyweight in the UFC. I think we know where his ceiling is, but that's okay in this division. Because clearly it needs all the help it can get. OSP would certainly help it. He's not the most exciting fighter in the world. He's not a great guy on the microphone. He doesn't really resonate with viewers like most fighters do at all. But at the end of the day, you need to keep the machine going. OSP is a great cog for this machine. And this, I tell you what, he can market himself as the Von Fluchoke guy. Because that's his second Von Fluchoke in the UFC. The first round was kind of, you know, I think that they're feeling each other. I didn't feel like Ovince looked too good there, actually. But then he righted the ship, brought him down, and tapped out De Lima with the Von Fluchoke, a guy who missed weight. So you got to resign him for the UFC. And that's going to be kind of the consistent refrain I'm going to have to say time and again every time we talk about free agencies. And it's what I'm probably going to talk myself into is UFC needs to resign these guys. Bellator needs to sign if they're available.
Yeah, I mean, and you ultimately wonder, and Sam Kaplan was on the Insiders podcast this past week, and he kind of said, you know, at some point you do wonder, you know, the Bellator's got a budget. Is there come a point where they stop just trying to sign every free agent out there and bring him in? And, you know, ultimately, it's what kind of value does a guy like Ovince St. Preux bring to you? But a huge win for him. Also on this main card, John Dodson, Stevie Ray, Mike Perry, all get wins. Just a vicious knockout by Mike Perry. I mean, this guy just goes out there. He puts on a show. To me, it's a better knockout than the AJ McKee knockout. I mean, you know, the AJ McKee knockout was a great knockout there. But Mike Perry is a guy that, you know, in a way is that perfect FS1 fighter. You know, as long as that fight stays on the feet, that he's going to go out there. You saw Jake Ellenberger earlier in that fight. He did take the fight to the ground. John Dotson, another big win for him, a guy that, you know, was fighting at 125, now back at 135. He has done some great things. And, you know, Stevie Ray does get the majority decision win there, 29-27, 28-27. In 28-28 due to that 10-8 round there in the opening round for Joe Lozon. But really, I mean, when it comes to those three fights, I enjoyed the John Dotson and Eddie Wineland fight, but man, the Mike Perry knockout just sticks out to you.
Yeah. So on the fight you mentioned there, the Dotson fight, more of the MMA hipster type fight. I think if you're a casual viewer watching that 135-pound bout, you may have lost some interest. But if you're a fan of high skill level, Dotson displayed it. He didn't get hit, and he did a whole lot of hitting. A nice game plan. Interesting to see if he ever kind of really goes with multiple combinations, but he does a nice job with those single strikes and kind of establishes his speed in that division. He's real talented, obviously. Ray and Lozon, well, this was predictable. Lozon comes in, dominates in that first round, near finish with the rear naked choke, and then he gets tired, and Stevie Ray takes the last two. That was kind of incredibly predictable. I love watching both those guys fight, but you're right. The storyline of those three fights has to be the knockout of the weekend. Just a brutal, brutal finish from Mike Perry, a guy who we both know is incredibly exciting to watch. Dynamic striker in terms of able to procure finishes or at least have entertaining fights. And he found just enough space within that clinch exchange to put Ellenberger away. I feel kind of bad for Ellenberger. I think he's had quite a few of these knockout losses here that have been brutal. But Mike Perry, I would assume the next time he fights will probably be on TV on some type of main card.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Jake Ellenberger now, 2-7 in his last 9 fights. You know, I think he gets another fight in the UFC. I don't think he's on the verge of not being in the UFC. I think they'll give him an opportunity, but a huge win there by Mike Perry. When it comes to the preliminary card, I think the two things that have to stick out to you is the two flyweight matchups. Bram Moreno gets a technical submission win in the second round against Dustin Ortiz. And then Hector Sandoval, that knockout win over Matt Schnell. We actually got a question related to both of those fighters saying, and this came from Justin, saying how close are Moreno and Sandoval in the flyweight title picture? And I think pretty much anyone in the top 15 is really in the title picture when you look at the fact of the UFC is looking for new title challengers. But you think about Brandon Moreno. It was, what, a year ago? This guy is the number 16 seed on The Ultimate Fighter. It was October 1, 2016, when he actually made his UFC debut. And this guy, the rise of him over the last year, he's not ready for a title matchup. I think he still needs one or two more fights before he gets in there. You know, and Sandoval would need a couple fights in there. But when you're looking at trying to find those next title challengers, you know, these guys are a couple wins away from legitimately being in that conversation.
Yeah, man. Great night for the flyweight division with these two fights. I mean, these were two of the highlights of the night at 125. Both these guys, obviously, a bit of ways away, but, you know, Moreno is a bit closer than one would think, I would say. Ortiz is an incredibly talented guy, a guy who's established himself again. I hate using this term, but it makes sense. The gatekeeper kind of at flyweight, and he looked good early on against Moreno. Moreno didn't really lose his focus, though, was able to showcase what he brings to the table in terms of at any given second. He can flip the switch and put a guy in big-time trouble on the feet, and then he followed up, choking him out. Moreno, just incredibly skilled, obviously dangerous, multiple areas of the game in terms of, like, at any given second against most guys at flyweight, I think he has an ability to put them away. And then I don't know what his upside is in terms of if he's going to eventually grab a title shot, but if I had bet my life on it, I would assume at some point in time in the future, Brandon Moreno will challenge for a flyweight championship. How soon? Not sure, but give him a big fight up next, I would say. With this win, Hector Sandoval, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this guy's career, but this was just a damn awesome fight, Jason. It was my favorite fight of the night. It only lasted one round, but the way it started was great. The way he spiked Matt Schnell, probably, you know, Brian Stann advised against doing that consistently. You'll hurt yourself. but got out of the guillotine and then finished Snell. Yeah, those were the storylines of the prelims. The other storyline I would raise to you, Jason, would probably be Jessica Penei getting that loss. That was one she could not afford to lose. I think I had it for Jessica Penei, 29-28 in that fight against Danielle Taylor. But that's just kind of the type of fight Danielle Taylor fights, and she's usually been the winner in these types of fights on the feet, kind of picking her shots and whatnot. So a tough loss for Jessica Penei, who's a fighter I believe the UFC wanted to market around and has got a string of losses here.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Jessica Penei because it's been since 2014, back at the Ultimate Fighter Season 20 finale, the last time that Jessica Penei has scored a victory. That was a split decision on that night. Since then, lost to Joanna Jędrzejczyk, Jessica Andrade, and now Danielle Taylor. Very close fight. Looking at MMADecisions.com, the MMA media was fairly split on that fight. But Jessica Penei, I don't think you see the UFC part ways with her. But yeah, she probably just one more fight. And a little bit of a surprise there. Scott Holtzman, big win for him. Talis Ladies, Alexis Davis, and Brian Barberina all get wins. Of course, the fight of the night was Cub Swanson versus Artem Lobov. And Mike Perry and Bram Moreno do get the fight, the performance of the night bonuses, all those bonuses, $50,000. I did have to laugh in the broadcast where Brian Stan was talking about Bram Moreno and how he was basically, because of all the taxes he has to pay, that pretty much he only gets about half of that amount of money after he pays all of his taxes here in the United States. But that is UFC Fight Night 108. The next UFC event is still a couple of weeks away, Daniel. It is not till May 13th.
Oh, my God. I thought it was next week.
No, it's April.
I thought it was next week.
Yeah, wow. It's April 24th. Here's the crazy thing. Our next pre-fight show will not be till May the 12th.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, I thought it was next. I'm in such like a malaise with the events every week. I just assumed their pay-per-view was next week. I might go outside.
To me, that's a great thing, though. It gives you a couple weeks to where you get excited. I mean, obviously, 211 is a great event that the UFC is putting on, but I like when there's these 2 and 3 week breaks, not just because I'd love to have a free weekend to do whatever I want to do, but to sit there and it gets you, allows you to miss the sport a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of got that sense with the UFC on Fox card not too long ago. And I think we only had 1 week off of UFC. So, yeah, man, we have a whole off season before the next UFC. I'll be interested to see what the pay-per-view buy rate will be for 211. But I will say that I'm looking forward to, I can already sense the excitement I'll have surrounding that card. You're right. You take a step away from the sport for a couple of weeks and then you miss it. And, this is a great card to come back towards in terms of that main card is nice and delicious. And then the main event on FX, Alvarez Poirier, yeah. Ooh, can't wait to preview that one. That's going to be a fun card to preview.
I don't know how well that does on pay-per-view, though. I mean, for the hardcore fight fan, it's an unbelievable card. But is it the fight card that gets a casual sports fan to put their $60 down for?
Probably not. Steve PJDS doesn't do it for most casuals.
No, it's an unbelievable fight card. I mean, I love it. I can't wait, to watch that fight card. Just sit in front of the television set with the boys and watch the fights. I mean, it's an awesome night of fights, but I just don't know. It'll be interesting to see how the UFC markets this pay-per-view over the next couple of weeks to get that casual sports fan excited.
Yeah, I tell you what, it is going to be heavily dependent on that marketing, because this isn't something that stands alone without some type of media concoction building steam around Joanna Jędrzejczyk or Andrade or JDS or Stipe. As it stands now, I wouldn't have too much confidence in this card doing incredibly well on pay-per-view, but potentially they have a couple weeks to regroup, really figure out how they can market this pay-per-view. But I do think for those that go and purchase it, they will there's a high probability of them leaving that event optimistic to consume more of the product. So this is on the marketing department. How are you going to market this one? Because despite the fact that JDS, most people probably know who he is, most people probably know who Joanna Jędrzejczyk is at this point in time, actually. it's a tough one to sell, I would say, Jason, but I wouldn't say it's impossible if they come up with a brilliant strategy, which is kind of unlikely, but who knows.
But of course, on Friday night, Bellator 178 took place at the Mohegan Sun up in Connecticut. Of course, headlined by Patricio Pitbull, becoming the eighth fighter in Bellator history to become a two-time champion as he guillotine choked Daniel Strauss in the second round. Also, you had Alima-Lay McFarland with a submission win as she beat Jessica Middleton. Syed Awad with a decision win over Ryan Quinn. And then, of course, that knockout that we mentioned with AJ McKee and Dominic Mazzotta. Obviously, I think the bigger storyline coming out of Bellator 178 is the fact that Patricio Pitbull was fined $2,500 by the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations for jumping onto the cage. And of course, I saw the tweet from Mark Raimondi with the story that he put out there, and I ended up reaching out to Mike Mazzulli on Saturday afternoon to kind of exactly find out. And you know, this goes back some time. You may remember last month, where Rafael Carvalho was fined $5,000 by the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations, which was the regulatory body for that event overseas. Bellator has hired the Mohegan Tribe to regulate their events, so they're not a self-regulated show, which I think is an absolutely a great thing. And Rafael Carvalho was fined $5,000. Now, the story that came out following it was, well, he was fined $5,000 for jumping onto the cage. Part of that is true. The reason it was a $5,000 fine was also because his corner men were not respectful at all to the commission and the inspectors for the commission. So that's something that Rafael Carvalho should be blaming his corner men for their treatment of the commission during fight week. So that goes into that. But Pitbull's fine was just for jumping on the cage. Now, I understand people go, oh, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. I even saw some media people say that was ridiculous. I would hope that if you are a media member, you would have picked up the phone to give Mike Mazzulli a call. And when I talked to him on Saturday afternoon, I was only the second media member to call him, to ask him about that. The other obviously was Mark Raimondi, who had a story out there. And this goes back to the rules meeting. Fighters were told 7 times during the rules meeting, if you jump on the cage, you will receive a fine. Let me repeat that. 7 times. I understand the Pitbull team is not happy about it, but the fact is, every fighter on that card was told 7 times during that rules meeting. Should be noted that another fighter did this as well on the preliminary card. He was fined by the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulation. And this, the reason that the commissions are doing this has to do with Bellator. You may remember last year, Darian Caldwell, following his win, which I believe that was against, I think it was a Joe Timinglo win that he had. He got on top of the cage and he did a backflip off that cage. He hit a camera person. She has, what I'm being told, has not returned to work since. So when a fighter jumps up there, the commission has no say what they're going to do. So this is a safety issue. I understand why people can be mad about it. But if you are warned 7 times at your job not to do something and you still do it, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. Yeah. I like the way you laid it out perfectly, everything. A couple things. I was there for the Caldwell fight. That was actually in Hidalgo, and I saw that happen. He did a backflip and he hit the camera lady hard. I think it was with his leg, and yes, it was scary, unfortunate, and you know, you only think about it maybe from the perspective of the fighter, but I mean, you know, it is a safety issue. You got to separate it to 2 different things. First and foremost, the criticism for Pitbull comes with the fact that regardless of what you think of the rule, if you're warned not to do something 7 times, and this is something that you can clearly not do, you can clearly mentally not jump on top of a cage, and you do it after being warned 7 times, and the reasoning is safety, that's worth criticism, and it's hard to have empathy for his camp if he was warned 7 times not to jump on the cage. So from that aspect, I don't understand. Now, if we're just separating and we're discussing whether or not someone should be allowed to get on top of the cage or not, that's where I'm more, despite the fact that I saw that happen, I'm more liberal with that. I don't really want people to get fined for that. I understand the safety caution. You can argue about safety for so many things, right? So many things. Practically anything in life, you can argue, well, let's not do this for safety reasons. I just think when you're talking about the incomes of these fighters, the finances of these fighters, I really want a really great reason not to to find somebody, because that takes away a decent amount of money. I know Patricio got a bigger paycheck, but you talk about that prelim guy. And then more from an aesthetic standpoint, there are some phenomenal moments in this sport's history of guys on top of the cage following a win. So you can't discount that. But it's also hard for me to make that case. And then you talk about the camera lady who was taken out by the backflip. So it's a tough one to grapple with, Jason. At the end of the day, I would say I would rather fighters not get fined for this. But he was warned 7 times. It's close enough where I could, you could flip me the other way. And don't really have empathy for that. Great win by him, by the way. Great win. He's yeah. champ now. Got the guillotine choke. But yeah.
And I would say that, you know, my advice to the Pitbull team is I would not handle this in a public forum. I would handle this privately with the commission, have a conversation with them, and figure out a better resolution to what it was. You know, I just think that it's sometimes very easy to sit there and, you know, hop on your computer, you know, and however you post it to Twitter. For me, it's on my computer, it's TweetDeck, or if it's on my phone, it's the Twitter app. It's very easy to do that, but I think that if I was Pitbull's team and to do it all over again, I would handle this situation privately and not in a public forum, because, you know, obviously, unfortunately, the narrative of everything that happened with him is what happened after this fight was over, not what he did in the cage. And I do think we will see at some point Pitbull Strauss 5. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see that in the next 12 months.
Yeah, couple things. Yeah, it's all about short term versus long term for that camp. Short term, it may feel good to get it off your chest, but what's the long term? Mazzulli is a guy highly respected. What's the long term of setting a guy like that? Granted, I will say that's the type of guy where I don't think I think he's mature enough to where is it, you know, off the shoulders. But again, long term doesn't make sense to do something like that when there's no real thing that will take place given those actions. Focusing on the fight, yeah, this was a definitive win for Patricio, forcing Strauss to tap. Despite that being said, it wouldn't be surprised if Daniel Strauss finds his way back up in the title picture. I think when you look at the landscape of featherweight, he has a greater likelihood of getting wins in a row up until another title shot. He looked a bit hesitant with his hand, which you can understand, but hopefully it's all healthy now and he can return to form, feel more confident, and piece things together. But at this point in time, Patricio Pitbull, 2-time champion. At the end of the day, a phenomenal win by him. Got the finish. This wasn't a close decision at all. It was, it wasn't like he went out and dominated him from belt to belt. But the ability to just finish the fight and sneak in a choke against a guy who was incredibly hard to tap out. Kind of a big mistake by Strauss to leave his head there. Solid win for Pitbull. I don't necessarily know what's next for him, Jason. I guess it's Daniel Wyko, actually. That has to be what's next for him, obviously. My bad. But after that, you got some young guns, right? AJ McKee, James Gallagher. Obviously, they're a ways away, but maybe not so much. It looks like McKee and Gallagher could be next. And AJ McKee, man, he stood out. This was a return to form, return to what we saw early in his career in terms of excitement, quick finish, looked dominant. And this was against a tough fighter in Dominique Mazzota.
I would say that, I mean, look, I think with AJ McKee, I think we were a little down on him. And when I may say we, I'm saying more the MMA industry, just based because of his previous two fights prior to Bellator 178 with both decision wins against Ray Wood and Brandon Phillips. I think of, if I was a James Gallagher camp, I would not rush into that fight if I was them. I look at James Gallagher and I think that you see the upside there, but I just think it's still some time away from him. You know, AJ McKee, you know, they had tried to book that Emmanuel Sanchez fight. It wouldn't be surprising me if that is the route that Bellator goes leading up next. But if I'm James Gallagher and I'm in the management of James Gallagher, I'm not trying to rush into a top five fight in Bellator's 145-pound division. I mean, I think if, you know, there's a couple names I'd pay out attention to, you know, Noel Lahat, you know, and John Scherer. I think those got to be two names you potentially put in. You know, you got to put Emmanuel Sanchez and AJ McKee. You know, we'll see what happens with the Chinzo Machida fight and James Gallagher, but I want to see more. I was really high on James Gallagher at one time, and then that Anthony Taylor fight happened, and I was like, okay, I need to pump the brakes a little bit, because in that fight there were things you saw, and maybe it was just a bad night, you know, that he didn't have everything going for him. But it was one of those things I said, okay, we need to pump the brakes a little bit here, but let's see what happens, you know, with James Gallagher in his next matchup, of course, being put it there in a big opportunity. But AJ McKee, I mean, you got to love what he was able to do. Syed Awad, you know, decision win, you know, very, very clear decision win for him. And Elimelech McFarlane, obviously a great win for her. We did get this comment on the MMAreport.com in related to Bellator 178 from Rodney. He said this: AJ McKee pretty much showed everyone that he is for real in the featherweight division. There are plenty of intriguing matchups for him, like James Gallagher versus Chinzo Machida winner, or Noel Lahat or John Serra. My money would be on Bellator matching up against Henry Corrales or Emmanuel Sanchez. Elimelech McFarlane keeps showing she's a real good grappler, submission MMA fighter. A good matchup between her and Anastasia Yankova would be interesting, but again, it's the Anastasia Yankova weight issue. I could see Bellator matching Elimelech McFarlane up against Vita Ortega, because I really think Bellator wants the Yankova versus Lena matchup. Glad to see Syed Awad get back into the win column. It would be nice to see him get on a win streak, but it's tough in his division. Patricio Pitbull is just good. His matchup against Daniel Whitehall is going to be a good scrap. By the way, Jordan Young was really taking advantage of his opportunities. He's gotten on the Bellator prelims. Jordan is definitely someone Bellator should invest in signing to a multi-fight contract. Also, I know Bellator is not interested in signing him, but I think Branko Busek is an MMA to keep an eye on. Ed Ruth and Tower of Fortune continue to progress in their Bellator careers. Yeah, obviously, Ruth and Fortune got wins there on that preliminary card, which, by the way, it's very interesting to see how they have match made Ed Ruth and Tyrell Fortune in comparison to what they're doing with Aaron Pico.
Yeah.
I when I saw they're putting him in there against Zach Freeman, I mean, look, I know everyone is super high on Aaron Pico, and they think this kid has a chance to be a champion. But for his first pro fight to be a guy who has 10 pro fights and just fought for the RFA title, man, that is something I would love to hear Dwayne Zinkin explain why they accepted that fight. Who is Aaron Pico's manager?
Well, we'll see what it looks like on June 25th, the day after that fight happens, because you're right. That's a bit different. I mean, with McKee and Gallagher, these are guys 22 and 20. They've kind of had a slow rise, as they should. They're 22 years old and 20. Ruth and Fortune, young in the sport. Pico, first fight against a Gallagher who had an impressive, like, he started off pretty good. I think 7-0 Freeman did. Kind of dropped a couple in RFA. That's a tough one for Aaron Pico, but I think you probably want to have him, no matter how talented he is, face an 0-0, 1-0 type guy. But people vouch for this guy. I mean, about his stand-up, obviously about his wrestling. He doesn't want to waste any time. At this point in time, we could be hesitant, but I think it's one of those things where we're going to have to play water cooler, you know, quarterback afterwards, or the day after, we can analyze whether or not this was a smart or really, really bad decision. I have to assume, though, that Pico has to have established himself as just an unreal talent.
Yeah, I mean, it's if he goes out there and wins, I mean, you go, hey, man, this kid's a legit deal. But the problem is, if his first fight's against, you know, a guy like Freeman, what's the second fight?
It's a title shot.
I mean, this is, you know, look, I've been critical of the matchmaking of Shorty Torres in Titan, and he has proven me wrong every time, and kudos to him. But the problem is when you start having these matchups, you can only go above that. And I just, when I saw that matchup, I was like, man, they're not giving him an easy path. And it's one of those things that if you're Ed Ruth and Tyrell Fortune, you see that, you go, and both these guys are competitors. And I talked to Tyrell Fortune 2 weeks ago, and I definitely walked away from the interview going, this guy wants better competition. It's just, it's interesting. It's a matchup that, I mean, man, are we talking about Aaron Pico, you know, is he on the path to fight for a title in 12 months?
I mean, he's in a position where if he wins in dominant fashion against Freeman, you would assume a bigger fight after that. If he wins that fight, you would assume an even bigger fight after that. And if you just do the math there, I would assume that third fight would put himself in a position to get a title shot afterwards. So
it's crazy.
Yeah, and he's 20 years old as well, same age as Gallagher. And Gallagher has been competing or training in mixed martial arts for 6-plus years. Obviously, Pico's been doing it his whole life in terms of wrestling and boxing, but it's exciting, man. I'm really excited about that pay-per-view. I don't know how it's going to do, but there are so many fights on that card that I can't wait to watch.
I still feel like they should have put Pico on the spike portion.
I agree with you, and we've talked about this, where this is a guy you want people to know about because he's a star potential, so put him in a place where he's going to get the most viewership.
Yeah, I would have put Bader and Mo on the pay-per-view instead of Spike and put Pico on Spike.
Yeah, I mean, Bader and Mo probably the second best fight in terms of pure talent level between both competitors, or third best. For sure behind Lee Malarkin, maybe. And then maybe behind Chandler and Primus, just because Chandler. But, I mean, it's a top three fight in terms of just pure talent level for sure. And if you took a while, you could probably make a case that it's the top fight. But obviously neither is champion. So Bader and Lawal, I would also put on the main card, especially because, you know, Pico may go out there and wrestle with Freeman. But I have this weird sense that it won't be like that. I don't think it's going to be a lay and pray type fight. So it could even be exciting anyway.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. By the way, you know, we mentioned about the next UFC event's not till May 13th. Next Bellator event's not till May the 19th.
Yeah, I was looking at that. I'm like, oh, is there McDonald Daily. I don't know how we're going to go about doing that, because I know some of these tabulated shows, by the time I record, they've already taken place or close to it.
Yeah, we won't it's have a pre-fight show for that one, because it's understand why Spike makes the decision they do. But you're talking Rory McDonald, Paul Daly is one of the best fights that not just Bellator can make. It's one of the best welterweight matchups in all of MMA right now. And for fans who are not in London, you are going to have to watch that fight on tape delay.
Yeah.
I remember when they officially announced that this card was airing on 9 p.m. and I put it out there, and I guess I was the only person that kind of realized at that moment it's a tape delay card, and then you kind of heard the fans. I look at it and I still, if you're Bellator, why not offer that as an internet pay-per-view to where the fan, I understand it's a Friday, in which they're not going to put a card on Friday afternoon. I mean, I think everyone should understand that. But I just don't understand why, if you tell me I could pay $10 to watch Bellator 179 live, I would do it.
It's a fight worth watching, man.
I sit in my office every day. And you tell me I could pay $10 and I can pop that fight card, whether it's live on my television or maybe on my computer, and maybe I can hook it into my television and I can watch Rory McDonald, Paul Daly, Michael Page, Derek Anderson, Liam McGarry, Lint Vassell, I would do it.
Dude, this, I mean, putting on a fight like this and not putting it live somewhere for some streaming capability for people in America is the equivalent of like looking at the landscape of how we engage with sports in 2017, how we engage with media. It's the equivalent of buying like $100 million in MySpace stock. It's just antiquated and it doesn't make too much sense. I mean, at the end of the day, I believe this card should have been on a Saturday and you'd run it live Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
But if you put it on a Friday, put it behind a paywall, or you know what? Just put it on Bellator.spike.com. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, look, and they are the only MMA event, major MMA event going on that weekend because the UFC doesn't have their next event until May 28th after UFC 211. Of course, that's the card that's going to be in Sweden. I mean, look, if you sat there and, you know, they did a deal with Flow Combat. Currently, I'm not a subscriber to Flow Combat. But if you told me that Flow Combat was going to have the international events and maybe the preliminary card streams, would I fork over? I think Flow Combat, if you maybe buy it once, you know, I think if you do month to month, maybe it's $20. I would do it. There would be value to me.
Yeah.
You know, totally. But I don't. When you're a sports property, I don't understand. I mean, to a point, I understand it, but I also believe that there is a good amount of the fan base out there that would do what they can to get, you know, to watch Bellator live. I think that if you offered that to people who live, you know, overseas, you know, live in London, I'm sure, you know, any of the, you know, fans over in Europe and Asia, whatnot, if you offered them the ability to buy, you know, whether it's per fight or by the month to be able to watch Bellator live, I think people overseas would do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the fact they're not doing something to the effect is absolutely head scratching, I would say, Jason. I mean, and it'd be interesting to get somebody on the phone and ask them why they're not.
Yeah. It's just, and by the way, I almost, over the, I saw, you know, Bellator goes, oh, live and free. I wanted to respond with, goes, please explain to me how I get Spike for free. Every time I see those, I am so tempted to fire off that tweet. Do you think they would respond? I don't think they would. They might call me. They'd call or email me probably.
Especially when everyone's cutting cords nowadays.
Man, the funny thing is, I don't know if I brought this up. Back when Rampage and Mo were fighting. So I was going to my buddy's house. He had just bought a house, and he just has basic cable in his house. Spike was not a part of his package.
Oh, wow.
So literally, we hooked up my phone to his TV to watch the fights. That's how we ultimately watched the fights. But it was interesting because, I mean, you see everything that's going on television. I just saw, was it Deadspin the other day talking about what 40 on-air personalities are going to be let go on May 1 by ESPN, and it's all related to cord cutting. I mean, it's... I was having this conversation with somebody over the weekend, and we were talking about cord cutting. And I said, honestly, the only reason I do not cut the cord is because of live sporting events. But I feel like we're getting to that kind of point where a lot of this stuff is pretty available.
Yeah. I mean, I would assume most people my age, 21, living by themselves, don't have cable.
I would say under 30.
Under 30, yeah.
But I'll tell you, I mean, I'm 35 years old. I can't tell you how many people that I know that are around my same age are talking about cutting the cord. I mean, look, I got DirecTV a couple months ago. I love it. Primarily because, A, I can record like a billion shows at the same time. You know, because, you know, back in my previous cable provider, I can only record two shows at one time, and then of course if you want to watch that television, you know if you record two things at one time, you have to either watch one of those two things. But which, by the way, I've actually fell in love with the MLB Mixed Channel. Even though I don't have extra innings, I still get the MLB Mixed Channel, which is kind of weird. But I hear more and more people cutting the cord, and to me, it's just, if I had the ability to get sports programming, you know, the channels I wanted for like $20 a month, I would drop DirecTV.
Yeah, I mean, and it's probably on the horizon, that a la carte type thing where you can get a cheaper deal with exactly what you want, and you don't have to worry about watching Lifetime, as much as I love those movies. So,
yeah, but you think like all your shows that are like on CBS, NBC, Fox, you can get those right on their website for free. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things where, and I think MMA promoters have to be, you know, eyeball on this. And, you know, that's where it's going to make the things with the UFC very interesting with their new television deal. When you see what the last Fox show did, what's that make someone think that they want to put $400 million a year for the UFC TV rights?
Oh man, I still think at the end of the day, it's going to happen, given the way sporting rights are. But you also must understand a lot of these big companies are more concerned about the upcoming deals you're going to get out of the bigger sports. You talk about ESPN cutting all these employees. It's probably so they can set the table when they have to renegotiate with the NBA or the NFL, not the UFC.
Yeah. It's crazy what the NBA gets.
NBA, man, NBA and the NFL, those are the two big properties. And then obviously, anytime soccer comes up in any of the leagues, you would assume people are going to bid. And don't forget about like streaming companies like Amazon, especially, and Hulu, and maybe Netflix one
I had
day.
heard Netflix was making a run at sports play-by-play, which, I mean, that's going to be interesting if that does happen. I mean, and look, I am a binge Netflix watcher. That's all I did pretty much Sunday. I binge-watched Netflix.
Yeah, no, Netflix, I mean, Netflix and Amazon, these are companies that look at themselves continuing to adjust, continuing to innovate.
What?
And this year for Netflix, it's all about, I would say, stand-up comedy and movies. They're releasing a movie every single week. And you know,
Well,
they're
and you also think about YouTube TV. That's
yeah,
what
that
Google's
one,
doing.
yeah. I mean, look, when you have Google behind you, and that's the thing here. Like a lot of these big streaming companies have the financial backing to take big risks, so you could see a crazy deal somewhere with some promotion. So that's the good thing for the UFC.
Yeah, it's crazy, but that is going to wrap it up for this edition of the Post Fight Podcast. Of course, you can always check this out on radioinfluence.com. I want to thank our sponsor, Fight TV, for their support of the MMA Report Podcast. Of course, I will have a MMA Report Podcast coming out on Wednesday. Going to have some Balor interviews a part of that podcast, so look out for that. Plus, we'll talk about everything else going on in the world of MMA. Of course, you can always listen to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and now on Google Play. Just search The MMA Report. Also, be sure to like The MMA Report on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMMAReport.
This is a fabulous sports big quick fix on Radio Influence.
Rick Saratella is here. He has to talk to us about the draft, the draft, the draft. Lord knows the babe loves the draft. You've got Dalvin
Right.
Cook and you've got Christian McCaffrey, and I'm like, I don't buy any of them. Dalvin Cook is good. It's just that he's got the labrum on both sides over here. And Christian
Right.
McCaffrey, I don't think he's ever carried it 35 times. I'm not finding interest in either one of those guys.
Well, you know, McCaffrey, I got to say, I was a guy that wasn't too high on McCaffrey. He's kind of won me over a little bit. I call him Danny Woodhead on steroids.
Yeah.
You know? But, I mean, this guy's hands at the combine, God, I mean, they say he has one of the best hands in the entire draft, including the wide receivers. And I think because the wide open way of the NFL, the passing attack, I think the value that he brings, you know, like the Saints, the way they used to use Darren Sproles, that could be Christian McCaffrey. You know, some people have him going now in the top 10, as high as number 8 to the Panthers. And, you know, some people like him number 20 to the Broncos.
The Fabulous Sports Big can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.